This is episode 205, recorded April 28th, 2014.
Greetings, AquariMixers.
We come to you this evening via the iPad.
Yes, I'm afraid the field recorder has shuffled off its mortal coil.
Which it really shouldn't have yet.
Because it's only about 9 months old and we have treated it with the utmost care and respect.
So we're going to be looking into the warranty.
Which it should be covered under. Yes. So It shouldn't be a big problem, but it might be a few weeks until we get an operational one again.
So in the meantime...
The iPad.
We'll have to do.
Yes.
So we have three people tonight. Roger from South Portland, who is new.
I believe so.
And in Pittsburgh, we haven't heard from in a while. So that's nice.
No, it might be. And we've had Rogers before. I don't think it's the same Roger, but...
Oh, anyway. I don't...
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
I don't know. Maybe I totally botched that. Tom in Provo.
And in Pittsburgh and Tom in Provo, of course, have contributed numerous times.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So we'll go to Roger first.
Okay.
He says, "Dear Russ and Kelly, I came across a video on YouTube that said Betta splendens is an insectivore and should only be fed bloodworms because they are actually mosquito larvae. I've been feeding mine exclusively New Life Spectrum Extreme and Hikari Bio Gold pellets. Should I supplement some bloodworms to his diet? Also, the same video recommended using sand instead of gravel due to the fact that it stays cleaner. What's your opinion? I keep mine in a large fishbowl with a Betta heater and no substrate, bare bottom style. I stuck a few marine pure balls in his bowl for some biological filtration. I was going to switch to sea chem matrix because they look like rocks instead of a boring ceramic ball in the bowl. Your thoughts?"
Okay, well, I would say there are several ways to approach this, and I hope to do so diplomatically.
Don't be too diplomatic.
But I'm going to say, well, let's just look at it in the form of asking some questions and then maybe answering some questions.
Okay, too. Can I say the words utter bunk?
No. I don't know. I guess you just did. I guess it's fine.
Now, go ahead and be diplomatic. I already got the fun stuff out of the way.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it's true that Betta splendens does eat insects in the wild, so it could be called an insectivore. I'm sure it gets other things too, you know, mollusks and crustaceans and things once in a while, and fish fry and so on. So it's not a strict insectivore, I would say. Although that probably makes up the bulk of its diet in the wild. But the idea that it should only be fed bloodworms, I would ask the question, why is that? Is that because the author of the YouTube video saw this as a natural diet for them? Well, freeze-dried, this is not a natural thing, and I don't know if that's the angle they were coming from. Not that freeze-dried is bad. I should really backtrack a little bit and say, adding bloodworms to a Betta's diet is a good idea, as long as they're fresh, you know? I mean, or we freeze-dried, but as long as they're in a nutritionally, viable state. And well-preserved freeze-dried bloodworms are definitely within that category.
You don't want to only ever feed them...
Right, and I would say that Roger's diet, that he gives them New Life Spectrum pellets, Extreme pellets, and Hikari BioGood pellets, all, you know, good brands of food. I've used all of them. They all seem to work fairly well. And adding bloodworms to that would be fine. Completely fine. A good idea, I would say. However, something about this, I would rather feed my fish pellets that are, you know, in good condition in terms of they're still within their...
Nutritionally viable?
Their nutritionally viable, yeah, period. Well, after they've been opened, then feed them bloodworms that are stale, you know, for example.
Right.
And
nobody wants stale bloodworms.
Right, and I don't think bloodworms are quite as balanced as the pellets. What?
Are stale bloodworms scab worms?
Oh, that was kind of disgusting, actually.
I'm sorry!
Don't you think?
Yes.
It was kind of disgusting.
That was really gross.
Yeah, okay. Well.
Oh, okay.
But here's some other things. Now, the assertion that bloodworms are mosquito larvae.
No. Okay, that refers back to my comment before, yes?
Well, yeah.
I'm pretty sure mosquito larvae grow up into mosquitoes.
Yes, they do. And
I mean, I'm don't have near your knowledge of insects or anything like that, but I'm pretty sure mosquito larvae grow up into mosquitoes.
They do. The thing is, the adult stage of what are bloodworms, you know, bloodworms are a larval stage of a fly, just like mosquito larvae are the larval stage of a fly.
Of a mosquito.
Yes.
And it flies.
No, but what I'm saying is, they are flies. Ooh. Right? They're in the order.
Okay.
They're flies, right? But they are different families, mosquitoes and bloodworms, different families. So, to say that bloodworms are actually mosquito larvae, even though the adults look quite similar to each other, is not quite accurate, because they're different families. And bloodworms don't bite people.
And mosquitoes are evil.
And some mosquitoes do bite people, but
many, many mosquitoes bite people. But there are
many species that don't really bite people, and the males never bite people. But anyway, the idea is that they're different species. So saying that bloodworms are mosquito larvae is an oversimplification, and it's inaccurate. I personally have collected larvae of both species on numerous occasions, and I can tell you that they look quite different.
Yes.
They do. Even you've seen that, right?
I could even tell like bloodworms and mosquito larvae.
You often find them in similar habitats, but you can distinguish them quite easily. The bloodworms are longer, thinner, redder. When they swim, they're in kind of a figure eight pattern.
Okay.
And this is a generalization, but, you know, they swim in a sort of a figure eight pattern in the water. And mosquitoes are thicker and more like brown colored, and they swim in a more of a zigzag pattern. They're very different. They're not the same thing. Betta's like both of them.
One of these things is not like the other. I don't remember if that's the tune. I haven't heard that in a long time.
Right. Well, something like that. But basically, they are quite different. Nutritionally, they might be similar. But anyway, the whole idea is, even if they were mosquitoes, why would you feed them to... I mean, why would you say that is the only food that they should get?
Yes.
Yes. Why would you feed them to the exclusion of other foods?
Yes. And just to clarify, when I'm making snide, silly comments, I'm not at all aiming them at Roger.
No,
just...
I think that's clear.
Just the person who put out said YouTube video.
Yes, and I don't want to...
I'm not trying to be rude. Remember, I'm the comic relief. I'm allowed to say these things, and then you smooth it over.
Okay, but I don't want to get in trouble.
That was my disclaimer, though.
We love you, YouTube person.
I'm sure you're very nice.
I'm sure it's a good YouTube video.
Yes, but I have to make jokes. Sorry.
Yes, but I really do think that I would question, you know, the assertion that they need to eat only bloodworms for those reasons. Because that we've stated that, first of all, it's not necessarily a balanced diet. In the wild, they would probably get some more variety. Second, because they're in a preserved state, they're likely to have lost some nutrients by the time they get to them. And over time, even more as they're kept and on the shelf, open. You know, the container has been opened. And then finally, they're not mosquito larvae, even though they're quite similar. And I've heard that said before.
Really?
That I've heard it widely circulated, I guess.
If they were mosquito larvae, people would call them mosquito larvae instead of calling them bloodworms.
Well,
don't you think? Because, like, if my shirt is blue, I would call it blue and not call it red.
Oh, I know. But common names are pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, and mosquito, how many different common names does mosquitoes have in English?
And it may be that some companies package mosquito larvae and call them bloodworms because who wants to buy mosquitoes?
Then they're naughty.
I don't know. I'm just saying that may occur, but I've never seen it happen. All the bloodworms that I've opened have always been bloodworms. And anyway, so that's my stance on the issue. Nothing wrong with feeding your bit of bloodworms, but... Yeah, I just wouldn't go to the extreme of saying that that's all that they should eat. Mm-hmm. So, let's look at the other thing. Sand instead of gravel.
Right.
Due to the fact that it stays cleaner. I guess it depends on your husbandry methods, really, doesn't it?
Mm.
Because if you've got a layer of sand on the bottom of a bed of tank, and it's a very thin layer of sand, it's likely that detritus will settle on top of it rather than in the interstices of the gravel.
See, I just said interstices. It's been a few
months since I said that.
Yeah, you gotta just throw that in there again.
Then it might be easy to remove with certain implements, but if you have gravel in there, you know, the food could kind of lodge down there. But at the same time, you have enough sand, and you can get anoxic layers going on in there, and even the release of hydrogen sulfide if you do have some decomposition going down there. So I guess it just depends on how much you use and what methodology you use to keep it clean. But I like Roger's idea, actually, of keeping a essentially bare substrate with a couple of bits of C-chem matrix in there, because they look kind of like rocks, and so it's more natural, but it's easier to clean. That's what I would do. Usually when I have bettas in small tanks, I go for a bare substrate.
That's true.
I've done it more than one way, but that's my preferred way to do it, just because it's easier to keep clean. And so, but the fact that you've got the little C-chem matrix in there, that's a good idea too, I think. And as has been stated before, it's difficult to cycle a small tank, so you might not get the ideal levels of biological filtrations you would in a larger tank in terms of stability, but it is possible to cycle small tanks, as I have experimented with myself and discovered it to be true. You can do it. It's possible. It's just complicated and not as easy or as stable. But I think it would be a good idea to do what he does.
Okay.
I would go with that. And, yeah.
I think that's everything.
Cool. So thank you, Roger. And I apologize if you have indeed contributed before. South Portland seemed kind of new to me, though.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because we got South Portland and North Boston.
Yeah.
On different ends of the country.
True. But that's not Roger. That's Bob. But this is Roger.
No, that's what I said. South Portland and North Boston. They're like...
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know... Aquamax, coast to coast.
True. Okay. So thank you, Roger, and hopefully that helps.
Okay. And in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
She says, we go then. Hi, Russ and Kelly. First, I wanted to say happy belated 200th episode. Thank you very much. I missed leaving a voicemail for the podcast, but wanted to say congratulations. I always appreciate how thoughtful your responses are. That part's Russ.
Oh,
I'm not so...
I think you think about your responses, too.
Yeah, not for very long, and probably not very wisely. How you take the time to think through others' aquarium questions and how you're open to more than one potential solution for an issue. It, along with your sense of humor, see that, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're funny too. Things. You say funny things too. Makes for a great positive podcast to listen to. I'm glad you like it.
So am I. Thank you.
She says, I made the jump from a 30-gallon planted tank with a canister filter to a 55-gallon planted tank with the same canister filter and about a 12-gallon sump. Quite a transition, indeed. I am 100% behind Russ's recommendation on one of the recent podcasts to use a paper towel soaked with white vinegar set against the tank glass to remove hard water deposits. After many attempts to remove coralline algae off of my new 55-gallon, new to me but used as a saltwater tank previously, that is what has finally worked. I'm so glad!
Good. I'm glad we suggested using that recently then.
Originally, I had just poured the vinegar on and let it sit, but that didn't work after multiple attempts to scrape it off. With laying the soaked paper towels on the overflow and on the glass for about a week, I was able to come back and wipe it off immediately. It was even soft.
Isn't that cool?
That's,
you know, I'd never tried it on coralline algae, and coralline algae is a pain to remove.
Tough stuff.
Yeah. So I hadn't even tried it on that. I'd only tried it on hard water
deposits. That's good to know.
But I guess there are some chemical similarities between what coralline algae leaves and hard water scale.
That's so it really makes sense. That's good to know.
Yeah. Carbonates and stuff. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Glad it worked out for you.
So she says, I wanted to bounce a couple of questions off of you. I have a 6500K/10000K96 watt power compact bulb on my planted tank. I've always had some trouble seeing some colors on certain fish. For example, killifish that have blue and red on them look brownish under this light. I originally had a 10,000K actinic bulb on this light and always assumed it was the actinic bulb causing this. I mentioned this to my local fish store since I now have Praecox rainbows, and at some places in the tank you can see they're bright blue, and in other places in the tank they're tan.
That's the same kind of rainbow, by the way, that we had.
Oh, same okay, species. Okay. The local fish store recommended the Marineland Hidden LED system in the 460 nm actinic. What's nm?
Nanometer.
Oh, okay. I'm intrigued by this because I think the 460 nanometer light should also help plant growth. These lights clip on the front of your tank under the lid, so I could keep my current light and add these to supplement. Now, they come in a white-blue combo, 6500K and 460 nanometers, and an all-blue light, 460 nanometers. Have you or any Aquamaxers ever seen these in use? Any ideas how they look aesthetically? I'm wondering if they would help see the blue on fish like the local fish store thought. I'm also wondering if the all blue would be too much blue for normal viewing, or if the white blue would be too little blue to have the desired effect of bringing out fish colors and plant growth. So I'm curious if anyone's had any experience with them before I buy them.
You know, that's an interesting question. I have looked at those lights and wondered how they would be in an aquarium. Not specifically with how they would affect the fish colors, although I think that's a good question too. But just over time, wouldn't they be becoming crusted with biofilm or hard water deposits or things like that? That was my initial question.
Is that because of where they are?
Because they're down in there where either they're above the water level or where they're going to get
splashed,
or they're below the water level where they're going to get biofilm growing on them.
How do you put the lights below the water level? Aren't they in the water then?
It depends on the kind. I've seen some that are completely
submersible,
and that may be the same kind. I can't remember if the Marineland models are completely submersible or not, but they are intended to go inside the tank, and they may well be the completely submersible type. At any rate, I wondered about that. How do you prevent that from happening?
I don't know. So we haven't had them.
So we haven't had them at all, no. Right. But I've just wondered about that because I have seen them and thought they would be interesting. I've done a bit of reading on this recently, just in response to your question, because I was wondering, I don't really know myself how that would work out. But one thing that a couple of people have pointed out, and I'll try to put links up on the page so you can pursue this a little further, is that the blue lights should, in theory, allow the fish to reflect blue light, and it should show off their blue a little bit better. As a photographer pointed out, you know, if you want blue to show up, you give blue light and you're going to get the blue to pop.
Okay.
Kind of to show up, it makes sense. But at the same time, you will get more of a blue effect with an actinic light.
Actinic
light itself is not as visible to humans as, some other wavelengths are. But you can see it, but it turns out to be kind of a bluish light, and it might be too blue, like you're saying. Like,
where some marine tanks
use a lot of it, and it works well in the marine tanks because you want the corals to respond to it, and that's why they use it. And people are comfortable with that. But the problem is, it does look kind of blue.
Those are the ones that we see, and they look kind of cold and stark.
Well,
blue light.
It is a noticeably blue light, so there's that. But it does... It should. I mean, we should ask, you know, if other aquariumaxers have had experiences with that, trying to get certain fish to show up. I read one thing that talked about there's a difference between putting an actinic bulb, for example, in the front of the tank, aiming towards the center or the back of the tank, and putting one in the back, that the best results come from aiming it towards the center from the front.
Hmm.
You know, and that you'll get a better effect on your fish. But anyway, something to think about. And any aquariumaxers who have any personal experience with that, please chime in, because I'm just kind of throwing out some ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yes. She has more.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, hopefully I'm not going on too long, to which we say, never. But after seeing some surviving red cherry shrimp in the second chamber ceramic ring area of my sump, I was reminded of the idea you had of a freshwater refugium with plants. Any ideas if having a shrimp colony in the sump would be beneficial for filtration? Unfortunately, I didn't realize that Praecox rainbows would be voracious hunters of the red cherry shrimps when I bought them. And the one in the sump is the only one I have left. I've kept them successfully with German blue rams before, with plenty of hiding spots in the plants, though I didn't see the red cherry shrimp too often. However, the rainbows would tag-team on one shrimp, and it was not cool to watch. But seeing the one shrimp looking very healthy in the sump made me wonder. Says, thanks, as always.
Well, I expect you could get quite a population going if you were to put, you know, a founding population in the that section of the sump. The shrimp would probably thrive there. Mm-hmm. And in terms of bioload, you know, shrimp don't add all that much bioload. They do add some, but not super heavy. And they would probably do well eating the biofilm that forms on the ceramic rings. Mm-hmm. And this is my thought on it. You know, I haven't tried that exact thing, but this is kind of the idea that I have, is that the shrimp would probably do a good job at keeping the, you know, the bacterial film that grows on the ceramic rings, keeping it from getting too crazy thick.
Okay.
And interrupting flow and so on.
So it would kind of help your filter work better?
Right, but they wouldn't kill the bacteria off. There would always be some growing. They wouldn't remove all of the bacteria from the ceramic rings, and I think
Keep it at a good place?
It would probably keep it at a good place, just kind of maintain it at a healthy level. Of course, they would contribute droppings to that part of the sump. There would be that to contend with. But I think that would probably be worth a try. I'd give it a go. That would be my advice, to try it. I can't see any harm coming from it unless you found the shrimp were so, you know, they overpopulated that area and you had to worry about lots of droppings clogging the bottom layers of the ceramic rings or things like that. But other than that, I think you'd be okay.
Okay, so if you try it, let us know how it goes.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Okay, we have one more, Tom in Provo. And he says, I missed the program last week. Hope no one was ill. And it was just the field recorder that was ill.
Yep. By the time we had figured out that it really wasn't going to work, it was make the podcast. So
we tried very hard.
It was rather frustrating playing around with it and plugging it in different places and plugging it into the computer and fiddling with this and fiddling with that. And it didn't really work. So that's all it was.
He also says, congratulations to Mick. May fangs and fins flourish.
And I hope it is indeed flourishing as we speak.
And that was some good alliteration.
Yeah, it was indeed.
Okay, he says, now a question. I'm hoping to set up a new planted tank, 15 gallons, and I'm looking into the DSM. I mean the dry start method, not the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is also referred to as the DSM. That's good to know.
Yes.
maybe we should look through that manual for me. I don't know. The manual of a person who says whatever comes into her head when she's recording for a podcast syndrome.
Oh, maybe it's in there.
They can name it after me.
Okay.
Okay. Of course, the latter may have stronger ties to the hobby than most of us would admit. See? You can find me in there. Okay. Anyway, as I understand the dry start method, it involves setting up a planted tank by putting down substrate, adding water to just below the top of the substrate, and then putting in starts of a carpeting plant such as dwarf baby tears, so that it grows immersed. Among other advantages, this lets the plants take CO2 directly from the atmosphere while they spread and establish themselves. Eventually, you'd fill the tank with water and add longer plants and fish. Some contributors on the forum seem to have had great success this way. Others say all it accomplishes is to grow mildew. No doubt countless variables are at play. Just wondering what you think. Have you or any other Aquarimaxers had success with this method? Beatus est pisciculus.
Well, I haven't tried it, but I have read about it. I read articles on doing it and so on. And so I can't comment from personal experience, but it seems like an interesting method. It seems like a lot of the plants that we grow as carpeting plants often grow immersed in the wild, at least for part of their life or part of the season or whatever. And so it seems a natural way to do it. And all that free CO2 in the atmosphere, it seems a shame not to take advantage of it, really. That I think that's one of the greatest advantages. And another one that I have seen cited is that it doesn't have to compete with algae. because the algae, it's, you know, it's growing immersed, and so it's not going to have to deal with that so much. And once you get it a good start, then it's all got some robust root systems and some robust growth, and it's ready to compete with algae by the time you put the water in there. So, seems like a good idea. Mm-hmm. If any of you aquariumaxers have experimented with it, we'd love to hear about that, because it seems like a good way to go. It's kind of a cross between a vivarium and an aquarium for a little while.
I guess that's true.
Anyway, there. Oh, interesting. You know, I wonder if you could. You probably could.
Probably could what?
Some plants like dwarf baby tears, you can grow them immersed. You could probably grow them in a vivarium like this.
Like our gecko
tank? Yeah, because it's a very humid vivarium, and it might just work. I don't know.
That would be neat.
But anyway, I like the idea of the dry start method, and would love to hear how it goes, and love to hear from any of the rest of you who have already given it a go, whether you were pleased with the results or not, because it would be valuable information.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's about it for this week, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
So, thank you to Roger, Anne, and Tom. And we hope that next week that we have found something out about the field recorders. So we don't have to worry about the iPad and keep pushing the buttons to keep it awake while we're recording and all that sort of thing. But there was one more thing I wanted to say, and it's funny. Our African clawed frog, Hiro, turns out he loves bean beetles. Who would have thought? Bean beetles are quite small.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought he would even notice them.
Yeah, but I can put a lot of them in there, and since he has a hefty appetite, there's quite a number of them. And he just eat them like popcorn. It's really funny. So we ought to do something on bean beetles, because you can use bean beetles for a wide variety of fish as food. And I have begun to culture them, so.
Maybe we'll do something on bean beetles.
Yeah, they're very easy to culture, and I never would have thought that Hiro would like them, but he does. So, I've read that they are good for a wide variety of fish. And since we like to talk about live foods and we haven't talked about that one, let's think about doing that for the future.
Okay.
If any of you have already used them and you have fish that have liked them or have fish that have refused them, then let us know. That would be interesting information to add when we do that. So, until next week, ladies and gentlemen,
may the fish
be with you.